user experience, and delightful Easter eggs baked into numerous features. One of my favorite examples of this is Jessica Ma's startup, Indinero. In 2008, Jessica enrolled in UC Berkeley's computer science program. She had a passion for coding, but a couple of years in, knew she was in the bottom cohort of her class. It's not that she lacked the skills or intelligence to be a great engineer, but she, to use her words, lacked the patience. Jealously, she watched classmates attract six-figure offers with sizable stock bonuses from Google and Facebook. Resolving to leverage the skills she did have, a penchant for writing, for attracting press, and for inspiring people with her explanations, Jessica started a blog, jessicama.com, where she wrote about software development, team building, and startup culture. Paul Graham, the founder of Silicon Valley's most famous startup accelerator, Y Combinator, and a demigod in the eyes of many entrepreneurs, what? I can make up dorky portmanteaus, was one of her early readers. He found her writing and invited her to apply to the program. As Jessica put it, "It was literally the day after graduation that I went to Mountain View and started at YC. I have high standards for myself and for people around me, but I wasn't focused on my coursework. I hate being told what to do. I started Indinero because I value freedom and flexibility." Over the next 6 years, Indinero grew from 2 people to 200, raised $20 million in angel money. Jessica abhors the venture model and turned down multiple offers to raise VC, and became a media darling in the B2B startup world. I asked her what the hardest parts of growing Indinero were, and her response was immediate. People management, mentoring, I hate it. I don't have the patience for it. When we were 10 people, she continued, I thought we wouldn't make it. I hated coaching and giving feedback and being patient while people made mistakes. As we got bigger, I got rid of all my reports except 2. I do as little management as possible, and it's worked great. The other big struggle for Indinero was marketing. While Jessica's a great writer and evangelist for the business, she never found a groove with web marketing channels like search, social, or content. But she was able to leverage her immensely compelling interpersonal skills, alongside her contrarian leanings, to build a powerful PR machine. Indinero's been featured in dozens of publications, and Jessica herself has been interviewed for hundreds of articles over the years. I do an excited dance every time I see her on the cover of some national tech or financial magazine. Each new piece is an opportunity to expose her business to exactly the kinds of customers and influencers of customers that Indinero's chasing. Jessica struggled in the early days, just as many founders do, because her skills and proclivities had giant gaps with what her business needed. But despite nearly failing multiple times, including once when she and her co-founder were forced to spend their personal savings down to the last penny to keep the business afloat, Indinero survived and thrived. How? By Jessica's gaining awareness of her strengths, weaknesses, quirks, and motivations, and then structuring her startup to work with or around these attributes. The near collapses of Indinero and the actual collapses that many startups suffer are often because founders don't understand themselves and how their companies inherit these traits. If you can identify and balance or work around the DNA that founders pass on to their startup children, you can build on your strengths and avoid many of the journey-ending pitfalls. The outsized influence of founders. Moz has always been marketing-centric. For us, the easy part is getting millions of visitors to our website who care about the problems we're trying to solve and are seeking answers to questions about SEO. These are the very people our products serve, and we're one of the best-known, most respected, and most trafficked destinations for this challenging-to-reach B2B audience. Marketing has never been our problem. At least never for long stretches. The hardest nugget for us to crack has always been the product itself and the technology underlying it. We've struggled, since inception, to create high-quality software. Perhaps when this book is published, that will have changed. Or maybe giant penguins will have taken over the Earth. I mean, honestly, either would be an improvement. Certainly, We've made progress over the years, but it has never been fast enough or high quality enough to outrun far less well-funded, less experienced, less well-known, and less well-regarded competitors. I've literally had professional SEOs who want desperately to be our customers tell me they can't wait for Moz to build or improve upon a particular feature so they don't have to give another player in our field their money. With loyalty and brand preference so strongly in our favor, I figured it would be easy for us to hire a few more developers and build software our customers loved. Almost every founder believes this to some degree. Hire the right people to bolster your weaknesses, and you can focus on your strengths. Cut to grainy film of me sitting alone in a dark room. My eyes are bloodshot. I shake my head sadly as I stare into a glass of whiskey. If only it were that easy, I whisper. Sorry, it's easy to get melodramatic about this stuff. The thing is, it is absolutely true that a balanced team, in which one person's weaknesses are covered by another's strengths, can be tremendously successful. What's not well understood, and usually only gets uncovered after years of operations, is how founders' attributes instill themselves with near permanence in an organization, while the attributes of the supporting team fluctuate over time. Partially, this is because founders tend to be around much longer, exerting more influence over more time. The average tenure of an employee in the startup world is only about 2 years. But even if you retain that supporting team, there's an undeniable, indelible imprint sourced from the founders' biases. The structure of the business they created, their recruiting, their delegation, their assignment of resources, their passions, and their blind spots. Time and again, I see this pattern play across companies of all sizes, industries, and makeups. Founders and CEOs determine not just the personality and culture, but the fundamental strengths and weaknesses that govern an organization's trajectory for years or even decades. Take, for example, Virgin Brands, which bear a striking resemblance in tone and style to Richard Branson himself, but also carry his particular strengths, a willingness to take risks, strong brand marketing, an affinity for youth culture, customer experience as the cornerstone of competitive advantage, and weaknesses, prone to short-term thinking, unconcerned with underlying technological or product innovation versus cosmetic upgrades, inconsistent financial underpinnings. It should come as no surprise, then, that Moz's founders, me and my mom Jillian, had no formal programming or software development experience or education. We fell into the software world through our marketing backgrounds and exposure to the field, leaned on our writing and business development skills, and managed to hire a few great folks early on who helped us build some revolutionary software. One story illustrates this perfectly. Never leave me is a weird thing to say to an employee. Geraldine had a classmate in high school named Ben Hendrickson. Ben is an unusual guy. He's 6'4", but weighs about 160 pounds. His professional demeanor is equal parts programming savant and absent-minded professor. Think Ichabod Crane meets Anthony Michael Hall. In 2007, just after we'd raised our first round of funding from Ignition, Geraldine connected me with Ben. At a Greek restaurant near our offices, over avgolimono soup and gritty coffee, I explained my outlandish dream to him of building a web index to mimic Google's. Every other person I'd talked to about this plan dismissed it as impossible, or at least impossible without the hundreds of millions of dollars Google had at their disposal. But Ben inclined his head, stared into space for an uncomfortable few minutes, and then replied in his booming baritone, "I think I can do that." He started solo, first by crawling, indexing, and storing all of the Wikipedia website, which by itself has tens of millions of pages. Then, in early 2008, once the prototype was proven to work, he and I recruited a second engineer, Nick Gerner, through a friend who worked at Google with Nick's wife. That friend, Vanessa Fox, creator of Google's Webmaster Tools program, was someone we consulted on the web index concept. Ben, Nick, and I sat down with her over Indian food, described our plans, and listened as she explained why it couldn't work and would be folly to try. Undaunted, The three of us sequestered ourselves in the dark back room of the Moz offices and, for another 6 months, worked on the project we'd codenamed Carhole. A reference to an old episode of The Simpsons, Moe the bartender suggests Homer is an elitist for using the term garage because Carhole was just as good. The name perfectly encompassed what we were trying to do, create a less fancy version of Google's index that was just as good. I advised on the product structure, design, and outputs, while Ben and Nick did the hard work of building the crawl, indexing, and data serving infrastructure, as well as most of the front-end application. We were burning cash from the investment at a healthy clip on salaries, hosting, and operations. Our revenue is growing, too, but not nearly as fast as expenses. The Carhole project, renamed Linkscape at launch and later Mozscape, was, we hoped, our ace in the hole. We knew our customers desperately wanted the competitive information about who was linking to whom on the web, and that Google had, a couple of years prior, removed that information from their search engine. Historically, you could use the command link:websitename.com in Google search to see the links Google knew about pointing to a particular website or page. We bet heavily that giving this information back to marketers and website owners would be a big driver of paid subscription growth. October 7th, 2008. I woke up in New York, excited to launch our new project at a major search marketing conference in the city, SMX East. I went downstairs to the hotel restaurant, where a crowd was gathered around the television at the bar. Many of them were clearly nervous or entirely distraught. Lehman Brothers had collapsed. Banks across the United States and Europe were waking up to their exposure to credit default swaps in the housing market. Stock markets were crashing. My email inbox had messages from a handful of reporters who'd agreed to cover our product launch that day, canceling their interviews at the conference, explaining that they had bigger issues to cover. I walked through Midtown to the conference center, dreading what might happen. The conference was a blur, but the launch, at least inside our tiny pocket of the SEO world, was a hit. Customer signups accelerated. Our revenue grew. That December, we had our first profitable month since taking investment. Ben and Nick added a third member to their crew, Chaz Williams, who'd built a prototype project in college that Moz bought from him and added to our suite. It was the startup dream come true. Raise money to build a big, challenging piece of technology everyone said was impossible, finish on time and within budget, launch and attract real customers who used what you built. We celebrated with the company's first holiday party. We put on funny hats and fancy clothes. Okay, fine. It was more like ill-fitting sport coats with shiny shirts. We were young. We took photos and drank champagne. We invited our investors, and they actually turned up to celebrate with us. For the next 2 years, our product got better, and our revenue grew at a fast clip. But in 2011, Nick left the company. A year later, Ben got an offer he couldn't refuse from Google. Chaz left not long after. We'd hired other engineers to help manage the Link Index project, but made only incremental gains and suffered a lot of challenging problems as we tried to grow the index's size and freshness. Over the next 5 years, we invested near insane amounts of effort, dollars, and engineering time trying to improve, but fell short. We hired more than a dozen folks to work on just this one project. Some worked out and stayed, others didn't. Parts of our software improved during that time, but our link data stagnated. Simultaneously, two competitors in the market, one a secretive operation based in the Ukraine and Singapore called Ahrefs, and the other a British firm founded by a passionate Russian engineer whose initial goal had been to build an alternative to Google's search engine called Majestic, grew to market dominance. After years of leading the industry, Moz became an also-ran in the field of link data. What the hell happened? We were the pioneers, and now we were being outdone? We'd done the impossible, but now we couldn't maintain it. Is this why Usain Bolt didn't run marathons? I've spent years agonizing over this failure. Night after night in bed, or at my computer, wondering how things went so wrong, what I did to cause it, how it could have been avoided. I spent hours in meetings with engineers after another quarter or two of work produced subpar results, trying to unpack our missteps and figure out how things went sideways. But I'm not a software engineer, so I couldn't even properly assess what had gone wrong. It was like trying to diagnose an illness without a medical degree. On an alien with three heads. Retrospectives, analyses, comparisons, competitive intelligence, anger, sadness, frustration. And the worst one of all? Helplessness. Jeff Atwood said that writing code was the easy part. Maybe for you, Jeff. I'd say it's been the hardest, most mind-numbingly difficult part of Moz. For me, marketing, reaching our target audience, and getting our product into the hands of customers has been the easy part. That's a language I speak. Impressing them with the product we provide? That was the nightmare. I was lucky when I found Ben, Nick, and Chaz. Their success at building a product others told us was impossible gave me a false sense of confidence. I thought I could concentrate on my strengths and hire to fill Moz's weaknesses. That didn't work out. Through multiple CTOs and numerous engineering teams of varying sizes and compositions, we were never able to recapture that magic Ben and crew brought to the link problem. Well, not until we got them back. In 2016, 5 years after Ben had left Moz, he'd founded his own startup, Idina, alongside his prior compatriot, Chaz Williams. Ben and I had breakfast together after I'd made a number of introductions to help him sell his fledgling company. It turned out that Ben had exactly the opposite challenge that I did. Marketing and customer adoption were non-existent despite impressive software under the hood. We talked about the potential offers and about the technology he'd built with Chaz at Idina. Upon hearing Ben describe the data ingestion and processing system, I wondered aloud if Moz should be making a bid for the company. Ben stared off past me, hummed for a few awkward moments, and then replied, "Well, have you solved the link scaling problem yet?" "I only wish."
"Then yeah, Moz should probably buy us."
"You know, you could have told me that before I introduced you to all these other bidders." Fast forward 3 months, and, via a creatively structured and lucrative acquisition, the band was back together again. Ben, Chaz, and the Idina infrastructure were part of Moz. Another year later, and we were, once again, leaders in the field of link data, with an index to rival our competitors and a lot of happy customers. I cannot say for certain that if I'd had an engineering background and counted big data software design and execution among my personal strengths, that Moz would have maintained its leadership and quality in that field. And I don't know for certain that if Ben and Chaz had been more experienced marketers, whether their startup would still have struggled to attract users. But I know that these are not isolated stories. They're practically universal. It's hard to pick the NFL's draft order if you've never played football. Every founder, or set of founders, has a different take on the hardest parts of building a company. And those same founders will have different takes on the easy parts. Talk to two talented software engineers who founded a company, and you may find that recruiting, managing, or marketing are perceived as the most difficult issues. Talk to the marketer and people manager who founded a company down the street, and you may hear just the opposite. The uncanny truth is that those hardest parts and easiest parts say less about the challenges and more about the strengths and weaknesses of the founders themselves. We all believe the problems and experiences we face are the most common ones, the ones every founder must struggle against. It's inherent in the psychological principle known as availability heuristic bias. And while that phrase is daunting, seriously, do not try saying it while drunk, the concept is a pretty simple one. Our exposure dictates our perception. If you've ever tried convincing someone whose politics differ from your own about the statistical reality of something they've experienced personally, you know the power of this principle. Just think about how many times you've had a miserable experience at a restaurant, only to find that the 238 Yelp reviews are all 5-star. The conventional wisdom, that you should bolster your weaknesses with great hires who can give you that strength, isn't totally wrong, but every time this advice is passed on, it should contain these three caveats. Number one, lacking deep knowledge and understanding of an area means that you are less likely to have connections in that field, less likely to identify right versus wrong hires in that field, and less likely to successfully recruit and convince great talent to join. You might not even realize which knowledge you lack. Unknown unknowns, am I right? Number two, a founder's weaknesses are often baked into the company's DNA and create a figurative kind of debt, non-ideal practices or systems, that must be addressed before progress can be made. If you lack engineering skills, this often manifests as technical debt that must be remedied through re-architecting and rebuilding core systems before adding features or enabling scalability. If you lack people management skills, it's likely organizational debt that requires months of digging into interpersonal and intra-team conflicts, letting go of some staff, rehiring, and creating processes for engagement and teamwork that build trust. Number three, when you rely on someone or several someones to bolster a weakness, their departure from the organization creates risk that the wound will reopen. This risk is greater in smaller and less experienced teams where the senior leader is often the glue keeping things together with their presence and lessens as organizations grow. So long as that leader has created consistent quality through redundancy of great people and great processes. Hiring or finding a skilled co-founder is not the only way to bolster a weakness. If you have great confidence or considerable fear that an area of weakness could be your company's downfall, you can invest in that attribute. But first, you have to know it exists. That process is eminently achievable, but few entrepreneurs have the self-awareness or take the time to diagnose. I've fallen prey to this too many times. My advice, therefore, is to be prescriptive and deliberate in examining your own strengths and weaknesses. They will, almost always, map shockingly well to those of your companies. Make a list of the primary functions in your organization. Now apply the following scale to those functions based on your personal aptitude for each. Level 1, theoretical knowledge or less. You have friends who've worked in the field and, in theory, understand the raw elements of the practice through lots of reading and a strong degree of interest in the subject, but you've never directly worked in the field. Occasional volunteering or pro bono assistance doesn't count. Never managed anyone directly who was responsible for this sort of work, and haven't done any formal training either. Level 2, managerial knowledge. At this level, you've had direct reports who did this work and completed a few successful projects. You've overseen retrospectives, heard the conversations, been involved in some tough decision making, and reviewed a lot of results. But you can't do the work yourself, at least not with any degree of certainty or confidence. You have to rely on what others tell you is achievable and the reasons others give you for why something worked or didn't. And it'll be hard to call bullshit with credibility. Level 3. Practical, applied knowledge plus working experience. You've done this work yourself, possibly alongside a team. And though you may have graduated to managing others who did most of the heavy lifting and details, you could still pick apart and identify pitfalls, potential issues, poor assumptions, or mistakes. You may have completed classes or gone through formal training, though in general, hands-on experience is the hallmark of this level. Level 4. Deep working expertise plus ability to teach. You've not only done the work yourself, but managed people doing it, achieved high quality results consistently over multiple years, and taught these practices to others. Let's use software engineering as an example, because it's something so many founders and would-be founders in the startup world struggle with. Just look at the thousands of questions on startup focus forums that begin with, I want to start XYZ, but I'm not technical. Assuming you're like me, and this skill is currently a level 1 or 2, your options to make this a strength are straightforward. Number 1, learn the process and do it yourself. Number 2, start the company with co-founders who have this strength already. Number 3, invest in the knowledge necessary to hire, retain, focus, and manage great talent in the field. Nearly every piece of advice I've ever seen ignores the last one and focuses on the first two. But after Sarah Bird became CEO, I watched her go from the low end of level 1 to the top end of level 2 and turn a fundamental weakness we'd had at the company throughout my tenure with only occasional success stories like the early Link Index, into a core strength in her first 18 months leading the company. How did she do it? I asked Sarah to contribute so we could hear directly from the source. Before Moz, my only software engineering experience was a computer science 101 course many years before. My lack of technical depth made me feel insecure about managing engineering leaders and teams. It was pretty easy to discern when development wasn't going well, but it often wasn't clear why. Was it because I had the wrong CTO, the wrong engineers? Perhaps the technical problem we were trying to solve was harder than we imagined. Maybe we didn't have enough resources, or the right resources. Were we underinvesting in development infrastructure and tech debt? I can spin myself in circles trying to understand the why. Here are the top things I did to become a better leader of technical people and teams. Ask questions during skip levels, meetings where a senior manager meets with team members who report to the manager below them, with engineers that go beyond identifying problems and into concrete solutions. For example, asking, what good development practices did your last company have that you don't see in play here? Surfaces best practices. When you find an engineer on the team who can articulate different strategies she's tried and the why behind them with conviction and clarity, give her power to try implementing some of those changes here. Be her champion, even when she ruffles some feathers making change. If some of the strategies don't work out, praise the effort. Read everything you can about different engineering cultures and best practices. Read dev blogs for companies like Spotify, Netflix, and Airbnb. There are a lot of great books, blogs, and conference talks about best practices. Invest time to consume as many of these as possible. For example, I follow Edmund Lau, a software engineer who worked at Google and Quora and runs the EffectiveEngineer.com blog, and Jez Humble, who works at UC Berkeley and runs ContinuousDelivery.com, pretty closely. Go beyond the slogans into the meetings, habits, and platforms high-performing teams employ. Take notes about the technologies and practices that you hear about in design reviews and one-on-ones. Then go back to your computer and Google them like crazy. Read everything you can about the technology. While reading, keep in mind that engineers are famous for indulging in so-called religious wars about why a particular technology is so much better than another one. Learn to spot it when an engineer moves beyond advocacy to naive devotion to a particular tech. Take everything with a heaping spoonful of salt. You need to know the lovers, the haters, and the companies that are using the tech. There's no such thing as the perfect solution, and beware anyone who tells you otherwise. It's all trade-offs. Recruit technical leadership with a teaching orientation. The best way to ensure that your CTO is going to make you a better CEO is to hire a CTO who likes to teach. Make it clear that you're looking for someone to drive change and educate you and the team. Beware CTOs who try to shield you from the details. Being able to explain complex things simply is a job requirement. Ultimately, leading technical teams comes down to curiosity and courage. You must be humble, ask questions, and read a lot about engineering. If incremental changes aren't getting better results, you need the courage to change technical leadership. Keep changing and trying new things until you start seeing positive momentum. And then get out of the team's way. That's Sarah Bird, CEO of Moz. This is the power of knowing your weaknesses, personally and organizationally. You can invest in them, double down on them, and benefit your entire company in the process. If you've got strong roots, might as well grow tall. Thankfully, founders don't just come with weaknesses, despite what our brains tell us while we're trying to fall asleep. A founder's strengths and passions will often become the organization's strengths. Smart organizations should use this to their advantage by crafting a business model, a team structure, a product, and sales or marketing channels that lean on these strengths and minimize, but don't ignore, the weaknesses. We did this unintentionally at Moz, but with great results. We'd created a community of hundreds of thousands of marketers, a website with millions of monthly visits, and an authoritative, trustworthy voice in the industry. It would be foolish, given that strength at the top of the funnel, to have an enterprise-exclusive offering that served only a tiny swath of our audience. Instead, we used a self-service model with a low-friction sign-up and onboarding process to attract thousands of free trials to our software each month. Moz aligned the strength of community and high volumes of relevant traffic to a business that maximized the value given and received. Recall that we'd started as a consulting business, serving only a tiny fraction of our potential audience. Literally, a half dozen clients a month at most. Transitioning to a free-to-try software subscription gave us massive improvements in gross margin, growth potential, and connection between our strengths and our structure. Know thyself, not just a biblical t-shirt slogan. There's a crucial prerequisite needed to double down on your strengths or combat your weaknesses as a founder, team, and business. Self-knowledge. Tragically, most of us have a poor understanding of our own strengths and weaknesses. For me, this lack of self-awareness led me to grow mutton chops, to teach myself how to drive a stick shift while watching exactly one YouTube video in a Belfast hotel room, and to start a software company with virtually no programming experience. Short of nearly killing yourself on winding Irish roads or going massively into debt, how do you figure out your weaknesses? I've listed a few of the most useful ways below. If only I'd known of them before I grew out those damn sideburns. If you're a founder, make a list of the previous successes and failures you've had in your career and of the elements of running a business with which you're familiar and comfortable. Chances are high that your weaknesses will be the items not on that list. Keep a running record of successes and failures. A shared document where people and teams record initiatives and investments that kicked butt or went off the rails won't be useful right away, but over time, you can categorize and analyze these and recognize useful patterns. When problems arise on a team, a project, or an area of an investment, do you or could you, or your founders, personally step in to provide the remedy? When you or the founders do the work in this arena, does the issue generally get fixed, or does your position get stronger? If the answers are consistently yes, you've found a strength. If it's no, you've got a weakness. List functional areas of the business. Ignore how you're actually subdividing the teams or people, and record which teams or roles have high turnover versus strong retention, which have an easy time recruiting versus a tough slog getting qualified applicants. These recruiting and retention numbers have strong correlation with strengths and weaknesses. If you haven't yet started your business or are in the early stages, use your strategic plans to identify hits and misses. Chances are some aspects of the plan are fully formed with high confidence and a strong roadmap of tactics. Others will have a lot of hand-waving and hopeful eventualities, with the details left to be filled in by either the people you hope to hire or a model of execution, learning, and iteration. That latter group will almost certainly be what trips you up. Ask. Question your team, your investors, your friends and loved ones, your customers, your past managers and coworkers. So often we fail to see ourselves clearly, leaning too far in the direction of pride or false humility, sometimes both at once on different aspects. If one person mentions an attribute of yours as a virtue or a failing, consider it. If multiple people mention the same one, you've got a more concrete answer. And remember, the more receptive you are, the more honest people will be. These tactics are not exhaustive, and they might not uncover all the risks or opportunities you'll need. Vigilance and ongoing reflection are equally essential and equally difficult. Those same strengths a founder shows in the early years of a company may turn to weaknesses at scale, just as practice and experience over years of failure and learning can turn a weakness into a strength. Chapter 6. Don't raise money for the wrong reasons or from the wrong people. The best entrepreneurs know how to tell an amazing story that will convince talent and investors to join in on the journey. That's Alejandro Cremades. 2016. If you want a better than average shot at being counted among the world's most admired, most successful entrepreneurs, you'll almost certainly need to raise money from investors, unless you're independently wealthy or your father's last name rhymes with rump. Fundraising is glamorous. The press writes about you, your friends congratulate you, your competitors fear you. The office and the perks improve, salaries go up, and supposedly everything else about your business, customer growth, recruiting, marketing, benefits too. Plus, it can win you new friends. My wife once physically stopped me from shouting, "Drinks are on me!" at a bar on St. Patrick's Day because I just received a funding offer over email. Keep in mind, the money wasn't in the bank, but I was already drunk on the idea of it, and two Moscow mules. But there are a multitude of reasons why, if you're not building a business 100% aligned with their model, raising money from institutional investors is a terrible, no good, very bad idea. We raised our first round of $1.1 million in 2007 with Michelle Goldberg from Ignition Partners and Kelly Smith from Curious Office. Since then, Moz has raised two subsequent rounds totaling another $28 million. I was privileged to spend a few years on the board of another venture-backed startup, San Francisco's Minted. I was also, unfortunately, the beneficiary of months of fruitless fundraising attempts, nearly every 6 months from 2009 to 2012. And I've spent countless hours over the years with dozens of other venture-backed CEOs and founders hearing their stories. My exposure to the startup investment world hasn't been as deep as some, but it's been enough. Venture capital changed Moz. It changed me. It made me a better, more focused, more ambitious entrepreneur. I learned more in my first 2 years as CEO of a VC-backed startup than I did in the 7 prior years at a struggling family-run business with my mom. The money we raised at Moz and the help of the partners who joined our board were remarkable gifts. I couldn't have come this far in my professional career or written this book without them. But when asked if I'd raise money again in any of my hypothetical future business endeavors, my answer has changed over the last few years from, "Yes, definitely," to, "Oof, I really hope not." Why? 2 reasons. The odds and the cost. I mean, you don't technically sign the deal in blood. Founders usually think, I certainly did, that when investors put money into your company, there's alignment in the outcome. You're on the same team. Everyone's cheering for the company's success, and everyone's willing to put in hard work to make that happen. Forgive me, but I have to take a little reality hammer and smash your founder delusion. Look, investors aren't jerks. I mean, some of them are, looking at you, Caldbeck. You too, KPCB. They aren't lying when they loudly proclaim that they're 100% behind you and want to do everything possible to help. It's true, in the beginning. But over time, their incentives change according to your performance versus the rest of their investment portfolio. That's when misalignment occurs. And if you and your company, especially your leadership team, aren't prepared for it, reality can hit hard. Institutional investors and angel investors alike face long odds with any individual company. That's why they place a lot of bets. A tiny number of companies will make the money, and the rest will lose money, break even, or deliver returns too small to beat the market. That is, earn more than the 8 to 10% compound year-over-year growth of the S&P 500. Realistically, the distribution for the average venture fund looks like this. Out of 10 investments, 5 will fail. Another 3 will return an insignificant amount. The final 2 will combine to form the bulk of any gains. Startup investing follows the Pareto principle. 20% of the investments return 80% of the fund. If you go into the fundraising process or come out of it, even successfully, thinking that you now have a partnership of equals, a partnership of aligned interests, a partnership where their success is tied to your own, you will have a shit experience. I don't want to spoil the end of the book when we're only in the middle, but trust me, it happens a lot. If you can't handle the suspense, flip to chapter 17. Here's what I wish investors would tell founders before they put money into their company. I invest in dozens to hundreds of startups. 8 out of 10 don't return any money, but I don't know which ones those will be, so I have to place a lot of bets. If you end up looking like one of the companies that will be that big moneymaker, I'll lavish you with attention, as will the rest of my partners. We'll make you feel important, powerful, respected, like a dear friend and close confidant, and maybe the kid I never had. If things go the other way, and you look like one of the duds, expect that our attention and interest will fade. It may start to feel like meetings with you and requests from you are more of a chore than a shared mission. One of our biggest tools in either preserving a growing company's prospects for success or attempting to recover a flailing startup is to replace the CEO. If things are going well, that's very unlikely. If things go poorly, especially for an extended stretch, it's much more likely. If you would be happiest building a strong, stable business that's profitable, that makes you wealthy and happy, that has reasonable harmony between your work and the rest of your life, we are absolutely the wrong choice. If you cannot imagine doing anything but grinding as hard as you can with relentless focus and demanding the same from the team around you in pursuit of becoming an incredibly rare moonshot of a billion-plus-dollar business, even though the odds suck, congratulations. Our model is a match. Personal happiness and successfully raising venture capital are rarely correlated. I don't mean to be overly negative on the venture model. If I seem harsh, it's because the tech media and startup culture has done such a miserable job portraying reality. And VCs themselves, whether on Twitter, on stage at tech events, or in the coffee shops where entrepreneurs meet them, don't either. Most will downplay the odds of failure, oversell the value they bring, and, if they're truly excited about your business, make you believe you're a world-conquering genius. For a very brief window of time, they are the ultimate optimists. And for a brief window of time, you'll be one too. How VCs lose, even when they win. According to statistics from the National Venture Capital Association, an estimated 30 to 40% of high-potential U.S. startups fail completely in the sense that investors lose all their money. But if you define startup success as delivering an expected return on investment, a whopping 95% of startups would be considered failures. That often also means they fail to deliver meaningful compensation to founders or employees as well. Considering the countless hours, stress, and effort it takes to start a company, receive investor backing, and put that money to work, that failure rate seems almost unbelievable. It's like agreeing to exclusively produce movies starring Nicolas Cage. Who would willingly sign up for such a painful journey with such awful odds of success? And why would so many billions of dollars go into it? Also, have you seen Ghost Rider? Don't. To understand this quandary requires understanding the world of venture itself, how VCs get their investment dollars, what their goals are, and how their funds operate. Just as it pays to understand the motivations and attributes of a supplier, a partner, a contractor, or a potential customer for your business, so too it pays to know how institutional investors operate. In fact, it's actually more critical than many of those others because once you sign up for venture capital, you're usually locked in for the life of the company, or until or unless you become part of the 5% that meets your investors' return expectations. Venture firms generally get money from four places. Large endowments from very wealthy individuals or families, pension funds from big employers, well-endowed university funds, and evil billionaire masterminds. Technically, the billionaires don't have to be evil, but then they just fit into the first category. Together, these sources of capital are called limited partners, or LPs. Much as startups raise money from VCs, VCs raise money from LPs. The venture capitalists will try to convince an LP's investment committee that their approach to startup investment opportunities, their team's judgment and experience, and their fund's assistance will produce a winning ROI. The best VCs are good people as well as good investors, but they're only human and beholden to commitments they've made to their own investors. Incentives matter, and until you can empathize with theirs, it will be a struggle to understand their mostly logical behavior. Their goal is to improve upon the rate of return that would have been achieved through putting the money into public stocks, bonds, or other investment vehicles. The target is 12% annual growth, which, over the life of a 10-year fund, means returning 3 times the fund size. For example, $300 million on a $100 million fund. Beating the market is hard. Like, really, really hard. Only about 5% of venture investment firms actually succeed at it. A further 10% will return 2 to 3 times, the next 35% will return 1 to 2 times, and the bottom 50% return less than their initial fund. Thankfully, for all those employed at the 95% of firms who don't deliver on their goal, it can take 15-plus years to determine whether a fund is successful due to the extended time it takes for them to make investments and for those companies to die, sell, or IPO. The only way the 5% of successful VCs make their returns is through enormous outcomes from a tiny number of companies. It's usually 1 or 2 investments out of dozens to hundreds a fund might make that deliver almost all the gains. This makes intuitive sense if you're a close observer of the startup world. For every Google, Facebook, Snapchat, or eBay, there are thousands of startups most of us have never heard of and never will. Moz and its investors can serve as a good example of why only enormous outcomes fit the model. In 2004, Ignition Partners raised $300 million from their LPs. Those LPs expect that, over the next decade, Ignition will return at least 3 times the amount invested. That's $900 million. In November 2007, Ignition used $1 million of that $300 million fund to invest in Moz. That deal valued Moz at $7.1 million, making Ignition's ownership about 14% of the company's shares. Let's imagine that in 2011, Moz sold to an acquirer for $40 million, a not-so-far-fetched scenario that we'll talk about more in Chapter 9 while I cringe at my past decisions. The returns would be distributed something like this. Rand and Gillian each own 32.3% of the company, and in a $40 million acquisition would each make $12.92 million. Moz's employees, combined, own 20% of the company and would share in $8 million. Ignition Partners, who invested $1 million in 2007, owns 14% of the company, and in that $40 million acquisition would make $5.6 million. And Curious Office, who invested $100,000, owns 1.4% and would make, in the acquisition, $560,000. Technically, in that scenario, Ignition's partners are beating their model's forecast. Their investment is returning 5.6 times the capital back to the fund, and doing so earlier than the LPs need or expect. But for Ignition, this would be a useless return. It sounds absurd, but it's true. Following this example, the partners would need to fund 300 companies with a guarantee of the same successful outcome on each to hit their goal. There's no way the fund can make even half that many investments, and the success rate, as we discussed, has a non-linear distribution that's strongly weighted to the top few companies. In the dispassionate eyes of a mathematical, dollar-focused analysis, it would be better to have put that $1 million and, more important, the time one of Ignition's 12 partners spent sourcing the deal, making the investment, sitting on the board, helping the company, into another startup. Read on and tell me this doesn't sound like an insane game of high-stakes craps in a Bond film, only with nerds. We're starting a venture capital partnership together. We'll call our firm Scorpio Ventures. It has a nice, subtly evil ring to it. We pitch some LPs and convince them we're investing geniuses, raising our first fund of $400 million. After a few months of driving around in our Teslas, meeting entrepreneurs at hipster espresso shops, and crafting our Internet of Things market thesis, we find a company we love, the Globex Corporation. We negotiate with the founders, agree on a pre-money valuation of $45 million, and invest $15 million from our fund in their Series A. For the next 2 years, we watch them grow like a weed, supporting the team by leveraging our networks, our wisdom, and our time. At our ninth board meeting, they announce they have an offer from industry giant C.M. Burns, Inc. for a whopping $450 million. The founders are ecstatic. Their company is worth 10 times what it was just 2 short years ago. But the Scorpio Ventures team is having a bad day. Why? Because $450 million returns only $112 million to us. That's almost 10 times our original investment, which sounds phenomenal. But to reach our promise of 3 times the returns on our $400 million fund, we need to get to $1.2 billion. The math of startups is now working against us, because Globex was our hottest investment, and with them out of our portfolio, the odds of making up the other 90% plus of our needed returns are considerably worse. We might even be tempted to fight the founders on the company's sale, arguing that in another 4 years, Globex could be worth 5 to 10 times as much as it is today. The founders' families and friends and those of their stock option holding employees might say they're foolish to give up a surefire, massive payday on the outside chance of an even bigger one years from now. After all, once you've made $100 million from selling your company, does a few $100 million more really mean all that much? But for us, letting the sale go through, and it's up to us because our investment terms with the founders give us veto rights over any transaction, is almost equally foolish. Upon hearing that we okayed the purchase, our own family and friends, at least the ones who understand the mathematics of venture, would be fully justified in telling us, "You're totally mad, Scorpio." Did I squander my youth watching The Simpsons? No, it was clearly time well spent. From this overly simplified model, anyone considering entry to the world of venture-backed startups should have at least this one crucial takeaway. Unless your business is in alignment with the venture model of investing in many failures to find a small handful of absurdly successful mega winners, this path is not for you. Get comfortable with the odds or don't roll the dice. The venture business is about outliers. If you want to raise money, or if you're joining a startup that's planning to raise money or already has, you have to understand these odds and this risk model, or you'll be an unwitting pawn in a game where the deck's stacked against you. If your startup raises VC, but you're unwilling to do high-risk things that could kill your business 9 out of 10 times, but might make you a unicorn, you're not aligned with the venture model. That misalignment can mean losing your job and your company, or getting in a nasty stalemate with your board of directors. Alignment means that you and your company are in this for the long haul and recognize that only an exceptionally unlikely multi-hundred million or billion-dollar outcome constitutes success. It means you have a plan for how to turn your idea into a company with either hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue or tens to hundreds of millions of users. It means saying no to the early offers that may or may not materialize that could make you, your co-founders, and your early employees into millionaires so you can play the long odds of the future. This journey, by the way, is getting longer. National Venture Capital Association data showed that the average time from funding to exit via an acquisition or an IPO increased dramatically from 3.1 years in 2001 to 6.8 years by 2014. Those figures count all exits, including many that did not generate a positive return for investors or founders. When Equity Zen limited its analysis to only those startups that had an IPO, and thus almost definitely generated returns for at least its investors and probably most founders too, it found that from founding to public offering takes an average of 11 years. In the startup world, even if you raise money, becoming an overnight success doesn't happen overnight. While this chapter is focused on venture capital, there are some alternatives for aspiring startup builders. I've covered these a bit more, along with some resources, in the books afterward. Chapter 7. So you've decided to ask complete strangers for millions of dollars. For the first 7 years of Moz's life as a venture-backed startup, we had it pretty sweet. With growth rates of 100% year over year, operating with a model that investors and acquirers valued at many multiples of revenue, we got a lot of attention. My inbox was regularly filled with invitations to connect with people and participate in events that seem outlandish even to this day. A dinner at Sheryl Sandberg's house, thanks to an invitation from her immensely kind late husband, Dave Goldberg. An evening soiree with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon at the home of one of the partners from our Seattle investors at Ignition. I'd travel to Silicon Valley and be swarmed with offers of coffees, dinners, drinks, come by the offices and let me show you arounds from companies and people I idolized. I felt important and wanted. But years later, when our growth rate slowed to 20%, then 10%, and it had been a long time since our big fundraising rounds, that professional and social validation from my fellow VC-backed startups waned. Our board meetings went from the most important thing on our investors' calendars, never to be missed, to getting rescheduled 3 times and being attended via video calls rather than in person. The technology press stopped writing about us. Potential investors stopped emailing. Sure, our products were getting better. Our company was still growing, and we were technically more profitable. But startup culture is about one thing. Growth. As fast as you can, at all costs. If I haven't scared you away from venture capital yet, don't worry, it gets worse. Because we're about to dive into the heart-rending, ugly, unfair, why does everyone get it but you process of fundraising. I kid, sort of. For some entrepreneurs, fundraising is part of the fun of building a company. They relish the exposure to critical feedback, the social aspects of those hard-to-get introductions, the prestige of being in meetings with 7 or 8-figure outcomes, and the congratulatory press and celebratory experience of finally closing the deal. That's not me. I loathe the concept of direct sales, of convincing someone to back you or buy from you, rather than earning their interest and attention through your good works and organic marketing. Little wonder I love SEO, eh? But regardless of your predilection or aversion to fundraising, the process is incredibly tough, with dismal odds. My goal is to improve yours by making my experiences transparent and providing a roadmap for how this insular, seemingly inscrutable world works. In 2009, Moz was growing fast, profitable, and at least in my opinion at the time, in need of another round of funding to help us accelerate that growth and dominate the SEO software market. From April to October, I talked to dozens of venture capital firms, most of them on or near Sand Hill Road, an arterial connector between Highway 101 and I-280 in Menlo Park, California, famous for its density of low-slung office buildings housing many of the world's best-known VCs. I'd spent the better part of the spring earning introductions to these potential investors, almost entirely through other CEOs who were familiar with or fans of Moz. Over the years, I'd helped out a lot of these folks with SEO issues or recommendations, and they were, in turn, very kind to me. I was 29 years old at the time, and had as much imposter syndrome as I would have had pretending to belong in the Batcave. In my first few meetings, I was so jittery and nervous that I can't even remember what happened, which is probably a blessing. I didn't hear back from most of those investors. But by meeting 4 or 5, I was getting the hang of things. You start with an email introduction, best delivered directly by one of the VC's current or prior portfolio CEOs. The one I'm going to read to you, as near a prototype as you'll find, came via Mike Cassidy, whose company Ruba was later acquired by Google, and connected me with James Slavitt, a partner at Greylock Capital, whom I'd meet that summer. Subject, Intro SEO Moz. From Mike Cassidy to James and Rand. June 12th, 2009. Hey, James. I had dinner with Rand Fishkin, the CEO of SEO Moz, a few nights ago. Great guy with a very interesting business. He's been approached by a few VCs, but he's really interested in the right chemistry. I thought of you. I'll let you two chat if there's mutual interest. Hope all is well with you, Mike. Smiley face. The email connection usually kicked off an introductory phone call between me and the investor. If that call went well, they'd ask when I would next be in the Valley, aka Silicon Valley. My 2009 fundraising attempt dictated no fewer than 4 separate trips to that valley.